that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come. Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened, with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country. And this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
It's obvious that there is no single ethnicity that can claim absolute majority status in Afghanistan and can resultantly proclaim the right to wrest control of the administration as well as the country and its organizations. We now present you an article written by Dr. Sa'dullah Zarei, a political science professor at Iran's Allame Tabatabai University in Tehran and an expert in international affairs. The piece is titled, Will Taliban Play the Role of US's Proxy Group? The article has been taken from the Iranian newspaper Kayhan. notable number of Afghan towns fall into the hands of the Taliban has given rise to many discussions on the international and regional level, including in Iran. The main question here is, what will be the fate of Afghanistan as a result of these developments, which majorly have military security precedence to them? Are these developments going to be followed by formation of a powerful religious administration, or are they going to initiate a more anarchical security situation and further disintegration of the pillars of Afghanistan's social system? Paying attention to the following matters is important to answering this question. 1. The Islamic Republic of Afghanistan has an area of 652,840 square kilometers and a population of around 40 million. 77% of the population speak Persian, while the rest speak two languages of Pashto and Uzbek. 99% of the population are Muslims, that are divided into more than 10 ethnic groups, including Pashtuns, Tajiks, Hazars, Uzbeks, Aymaks, Turkmens, Baluch, Pashais, and Sardats. Among these, Pashtuns are the largest of the communities, with a population of 16 million that form 39.5% of the Afghan population. They comprise devotees to Sunni Islam, the majority of the Pashtuns, and Shia Muslims, the minority. Second in size are the Tajiks, with around 13 million in number, that shape 32.5% of the population and are principally Sunni Muslims, who mostly live in the cities of Herat, Mazar-e-Sharif, Kabul, and Ghazni. Third come the Hazaras, who are roughly 8 million in number and take up to 20% of the population and are distributed across various provinces. The fourth largest group are the Turkic Uzbek people, with a 10% share of the Afghan population, and they make up about 4 million of Afghanistan's population. Shia Muslims among these are 7 million in number and are spread among the Tajiks, Pashtuns, Bizilbash, Sardats, Hazaras, and others. The Shia faithful are mostly found in the provinces of Bamyan, Ghazni, including its Jaghori, Malestan, and Nawur districts, Sarapol province, including its Balkhab district, and Deykundi, the Parwan province's Sheikh Ali district, and the Ghor province's Lal Wasarjandal district, as well as the country's cities of Kabul, Herat, and Mazar-e-Sharif. Therefore, it is obvious that there is no single ethnicity that can claim absolute majority status in Afghanistan and can resultantly proclaim the right to wrest control of the administration as well as the country and its organizations. Of course, between 75 to 80% of the population adhere to the Hanafi Sunni school. It is consequently natural for the administration to fall into line with the school's principles concerning the laws and fundamental rights that it defines. And this happens to be the case right now. However, it should be noted that Afghanistan's divisions, like those of Iraq, Lebanon, etc., are based on ethnicities and not religious groups. Point number two, the Taliban militant group rose around 1991 during the Afghan Civil War and held the power in the country from 1996 until 2001. It is said that the American-Pakistani-Saudi triangle played an essential part in its preliminary formation and growth. The Taliban represents at most 30% of Afghanistan's manifold society. On the back of its religious background and the agenda that it has set up for itself under the banner of the Islamic Emirate, the Taliban cannot find takers among non-Pashtun ethnic groups. The Pashtuns themselves are subsumed under three movements: a Sunni religious movement, which is educationally fed by Pakistan's Haqqani and other schools, a religious Shia Pashtun movement, and a non-religious Sunni Pashtun movement that supports non-religious ideas. The first religious movement, namely the Taliban, would be representing 30% of the Afghan people, or about 12 million people, even if it attracts 3/4 of the entire Pashtun ethnicity. What is currently being pursued by the Taliban is absolute control over Afghanistan and practical subtraction of the shares and rights that are entitled to the rest of the ethnicities. This would amount to a 30% minority control over the entire Afghanistan. This is while Tajiks form a bigger minority with a 13 million strong population. The point to be mentioned here is that Taliban's words and pledges are separated by a critical distance from its background on the one hand and its actions on the other. Today's Taliban insists they accept that both the group and the Taliban of the past, besides the group's desired rule and the previous emirate, are fundamentally different. But the method that the Taliban has adopted towards gaining control over Afghanistan rests on forcing other ethnicities and religious groups into submitting to its absolute rule. This, in fact, amounts to a new form of the group's totalitarianism, and it would definitely take up arms to silence others and turn its back on its current pledges if it got to obtain control over Afghanistan. The Taliban is now insisting on formation of the Islamic Emirate and does not back down from it, while around 70% of the people and the absolute majority of the ethnic groups are against this idea. The Taliban dismisses the constitution that has been approved by the Afghan majority and does not even accept to come to terms with it. It is incapable of finding any more than a 30% following, exactly because it opposes parliamentary elections or the capacity of the president. Therefore, it is thinking of a lawyer jirga, whose members are appointed by a Pashtun majority and a minority that consists of others. And this means that with the formation of such a system, the Afghan people will not get to enjoy their real rights and shares across the government structure for years to come. Having attacked the northern regions, the Taliban is currently fighting the Tajik, Hazara, and Uzbek ethnicities. Each day, some people die from each side, and this translates into recurrence of the ethnic war in Afghanistan. The Taliban insistently claims that it has peacefully captured the northern towns and has no warlike intentions, but it is not true, as witnessed by hundreds of fatalities and thousands of people who have been misplaced from the northern areas of the country. Taliban insists that it will not hurt the Shias and respects the Islamic Republic's borders, but its method of resorting to force towards wresting control over Afghanistan has faced the future of the Shias and our borders with uncertainty. Of course, the Shias are capable of putting up serious defense, and the Islamic Republic of Iran does not allow the slightest incursion against its own borders. The Shias and the Islamic Republic of Iran are going to bear whatever the cost all of this could carry for them, and this issue cannot amount to a source of concern. Point number three. Another point is that, as stated in the previous part, establishment of an absolute Taliban rule is not as easy as they think and the United States have thought. We witnessed that the Taliban could not obtain absolute control from 1991 to 1996, and therefore the war went on in the northern areas of the country during this period. The Taliban cannot seize 100% of Afghan territory and establish its emirate without coming to agreement with other ethnic groups and offering a clear outlook of all-inclusive and popular rule that takes cognizance of the rights of all ethnic groups in the country. Even now that the Taliban's media have put pictures of the group's absolute victory on display, more than 50% or 183 of Afghanistan's 369 districts are outside their control. An intense war and confrontation is still going on in 136 districts. However, the group alleges that it has gained control over 90% of Afghan territory. The rule desired by the Taliban does not translate to any rule at all, but comprises of a scene of constant fighting among various ethnic groups. And this is not something that could change by the group changing its discourse, while it still insists on its most essential previous ideological elements. And point number four, amid all of this, the share of the United States is very important. Based on its duty throughout the past 20 years that the United States has been enjoying control over Afghanistan's political and security military sector, Washington has been supposed to train and equip the Afghan army to assume military security duties. But because it's been unable to do so after 20 years of occupying the country under the pretext of confronting the Taliban, it is now instead implementing a plan that bears all the hallmarks of an intrigue. A plan whose result is military confrontation across more than 136 Afghan districts, 37% of Afghan soil. Now the essential question is, what is the hidden aspect of these ethnic conflicts that have risen like a specter over Afghanistan as a result of the Doha talks? Did the United States know that the Taliban cannot gain control over Afghanistan alone? Then why did it not do something to strike a balance of power between the Taliban and the Pashtun government of Ashraf Ghani, and has practically turned Afghanistan into a scene of confrontation by refusing to equip the Afghan army and preventing its equipment by others? Will the Taliban be playing the role of US's proxy group to harness the support of opponents in Afghanistan and the region from now on?
Inside Israel. Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holot right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
These are happening in prisons across Israel. In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's YNET News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room, without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the immigration authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-aged children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. TrafLab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squad or entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help them.
Okay, so yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either, at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking, and you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews. I was in a trial yesterday of Salomon Tuka, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. Then he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established the Zionists, that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries. East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism till today. So basically, we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been, their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as less, as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was canceled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Holot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
the immigrants, and there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
Here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our prime minister is criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. Neither it doesn't respect international law, the Geneva Convention. It has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries, I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through. Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now, it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Firefighters are working in extreme heat to contain a number of wildfires raging across western United States, with the largest burning in California and Oregon, as another heat wave bakes the region and puts strain on power grids. The Beckwith Complex, which is the largest wildfire of the year in California, was raging along the Nevada state line and has burnt about 140 square miles, or 360 square kilometers, as of Monday, 12th of July. State regulators have asked consumers to voluntarily conserve as much as electricity as possible to avoid any power outages starting in the afternoon. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled "Wildfires Blaze Across Western States as Heatwave Shatters Records." Please stay with us for more. Firefighters are working in extreme heat to contain a number of wildfires raging across western United States, with the largest burning in California and Oregon, as another heat wave bakes the region and puts strain on power grids. The Beckwith Complex, which is the largest wildfire of the year in California, was raging along the Nevada state line and has burnt about 140 square miles, that is 360 square kilometers, as of Monday, 12th of July. State regulators have asked consumers to voluntarily conserve as much as electricity as possible to avoid any power outages starting in the afternoon. In Oregon, the Bootleg Fire exploded to 240 square miles as it raced through heavy timber in the Fremont-Winema National Forest near the Kalamath County town of Sprague River. The wildfire has put pressure on the power grid of neighboring California, disrupting service on three transmission lines, providing up to 5,500 megawatts of electricity to the state. Hundreds of residents in the Kalamath Fall area are under mandatory evacuation orders. The Bootleg Fire will see the potential for extreme growth today, said the National Weather Service in Medford, Oregon. And in southeast Washington state, a wildfire has grown to almost 60 square miles, while in Idaho, Governor Brad Little has mobilized the National Guard to help fight wildfires sparked after lightning storms swept across the drought-stricken region. The blazes are spreading as extreme temperatures continue to blast the American West, with excessive heat warnings remaining in many places on Monday. Over the weekend, Death Valley hit a scorching 130 degrees Fahrenheit, marking what could be the highest reliably recorded ambient temperature on Earth. Palm Springs in Southern California hit a record high temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit on Saturday, 10th of July, while Las Vegas, Nevada tied the all-time record high of 117 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service warned the dangerous conditions could cause heat-related illnesses. In Arizona, a small plane crashed on Saturday, 10th of July, during a survey of a wildfire in rural Mojave County, killing both crew members on board. The Beech C-90 aircraft was helping perform reconnaissance over the lightning-caused Cedar Basin fire, which was sparked by lightning near the tiny community of Wickiup, northwest of Phoenix, Arizona, when it went down around noon. Officials identified the victims as Jeff Pichura, a 62-year-old, a retired Tucson area fire chief who was working for the Coronado National Forest, and Matthew Miller, a 48-year-old, a pilot with Falcon Executive Aviation, contracted by the U.S. Forest Service. The National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, is investigating the crash. Our hearts go out to the families of our brave wildland firefighters, as Arizona Bureau of Land Management spokesperson said. The Beckwith Complex fire, a combination of two lightning-caused blazes burning 45 miles north of Lake Tahoe, is burning the California-Nevada border after exploding in size over the weekend. Plumas National Forest officials said firefighters had successfully contained almost a quarter of the blaze, but still expected some extreme fire activity. Evacuation orders were in effect for more than 3,000 residents of remote areas of California's Lassen and Plumas counties and Nevada's Washoe County. Some structures were destroyed over the weekend in Doyle, California, a town of about 600 residents. A damage assessment team has arrived to validate and assess reports of structure damaged or destroyed, a forest statement said. A new fire broke out on Sunday afternoon in the Sierra Nevada south of Yosemite National Park, and by evening had exploded over more than 6 square miles or 15 square kilometers, triggering evacuation areas of two counties. The fire size, however, remained unchanged early on Monday, and was 5% contained. The highway that leads to the Yosemite National Park's southern entrance remained open. Bob Prairie, who lives in Doyle, California, said he saw at least 6 houses being destroyed by the wildfire. "It seems like the worst is over in town, but back on the mountainside, the fire's still going strong. Not sure what's going to happen if the wind changes direction," Prairie said.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The Judiciary Transformation Plan is a solid and practical plan. The movement has begun. Well, a plan was prepared in the judiciary. Later, this plan was revised and we saw the second upgraded version of that plan presented by Mr. Raisi. The plan is good and well prepared. Some plans are prepared here and there for the sake of formality and they only state some bland generalities. But there is no generality in this plan. This plan is a good, strong plan. It is specifically long-term and it has a timetable for various projects. It has determined the basis and direction of the movement, which indicates that this plan is, in the true sense of the word, operational. And not a plan with extravagant and impractical goals. This is a good plan, and you should use it as the standard for your work. Of course, it may be necessary to update this plan over time, but this does not mean that the trajectory should be subject to constant change. The path must be a clear and direct path. Another point is that everyone should be informed of this plan. I have received reports that some influential people in the judiciary do not know about it correctly. The plan should be made public so that experts in the judiciary branch can see it. Firstly, everyone should define and understand their duties on the basis of the plan. And secondly, if they have an opinion, they should reflect it to higher authorities, so no one should remain uninformed. The necessity to fill the legal gaps. Another thing about the plan is that I heard there are some legal vacuums. That is, laws are needed to fully implement this document. You have to pursue these laws and you should not wait for the Majlis to do so. You could prepare the required law and do not let the gap remain unfilled. In addition, the body of the judiciary branch should be encouraged to implement this plan. You can implement all kinds of encouragements and incentives. This was one point about the transformation plan in the judiciary branch and its complete execution and follow-up process.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objections to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington, Over the past years, the U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation.